This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region, so thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of July 22nd, 2024. In business news, here's a phrase you don't expect to hear this time of year. Snow Day. But that's what the Phoenix Zoo recently celebrated. Christina Estes reports on the cool experience for animals and humans.
It's not a typical sound or sight at the Phoenix Zoo. Four guys feed 40-pound bags of ice into a machine that blows out 10 tons of snow.
So we're going into our mandrel exhibit now. We're going to drop just about a cart full of snow in there for them.
Tyson Marshall is the primate keeper.
The baboons were definitely very interested in it.
Anna, the female, scoops a handful of snow, while Moja, the male, picks at a frozen treat made of Gatorade and sprinkled with raisins, bananas, and nuts.
He just grabbed a big hunk of ice.
At another exhibit, an orangutan entertained a crowd that included 12-year-old Charlie Grindle.
Yeah, at the bottom of the popsicle, there's peanuts, and he, took one out of the thing and then brought it out of his mouth, cracked it open, and then put it back in his mouth.
Some of the animals get what the keepers call bloodsicles. The zoo's Linda Hardwick explains the red drizzles in the snow pile for the African painted dogs.
It's diluted blood. It's from the drippings from the meat. I mean, they're carnivores, so that's what they would eat in the wild anyway. They would eat carcasses, meat, blood.
Danielle Wong, the zoo's behavioral enhancement coordinator, says animals benefit in different ways.
It could be a manner of cooling them down. It could be a manner of presenting it with food, and then they're engaging in those foraging behaviors. Or it could just be a manner of it's a totally new experience, and they really think it's cool.
The tiger's frozen treat captured 8-year-old Kirsten Endine's attention. It was stuffed with fish.
The tiger just pawed with it and, ate it. It swallowed the fish whole.
It's the third year SRP has sponsored a snow day at the zoo, but keeper Tyson Marshall says ice treats are common during the summer, along with other heat relief tools.
Some of our exhibits have cooling pads where they can lay down. It's just cold water running through it. We have swamp coolers. We have misters and fans. We can also do some of our buildings have air conditioning. We can bring in our animals. They can have access to about half or a portion of the night house. And that way they have a cooling option where they can choose to be inside AC or go outside and enjoy the outdoors.
More than 3,000 animals representing nearly 400 species live at the Phoenix Zoo.
Go, monkey! Go, monkey!
It's so much fun watching how they respond to it. They roll it around. It's like getting a big lollipop. They're having so much fun.
While visitors enjoy watching them romp around and lick bucket-sized popsicles, Danielle Wong says not everyone wants to play, and that's okay.
Some of our animals, even if they were coming from a colder climate, they might go, I don't think so. So behavioral enrichment, it's totally up to the animals if they choose and want to participate in engaging with it. We just like to give them that opportunity, and we like to encourage them to utilize it.
They're like little humans.
He's gone. He ate all the peanuts, and now that's it?
With temperatures well above 110 degrees, most choose to dig in before the snow melts.
There he goes.
Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You can check out video and photos of the animals enjoying the snow and ice treats at our website, kjzz.org. The Maricopa County Medical Examiner says admissions for suspected heat-related death cases have now started to slow down after a surge in late June and early July, Catherine Davis-Young reports.
Maricopa County is investigating nearly 400 possible heat-related deaths so far this year. 27 deaths have been confirmed. Those numbers are about 10% higher than at the same point last summer. This June was the hottest on record for Phoenix, and July has averaged more than 6 degrees above normal so far. But Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Jeff Johnston notes drug use and homelessness are also major factors.
Certainly it's getting hotter, but there's also, I think, this post-pandemic effect of just having more vulnerable people. people.
The number of heat deaths in the county has risen to a new record every year since 2016. Johnston says the last two summers have been particularly overwhelming for his office, and he says this summer has been similar. But Johnston says it's too soon to tell if 2024 will break yet another record. Catherine Davis-Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In health news, we know summer heat in Phoenix can be deadly. Last year, 645 people died of heat-related causes in Maricopa County. Nearly half of those deaths were among the unhoused population. A street medicine team is trying a new intervention they hope will reduce the death toll. Kathy Ritchie reports.
On a hot Thursday morning at the Burnage Soup Kitchen in Northwest Phoenix, it's already 99 degrees. Nurse practitioner Perla Puebla is under a pop-up canopy, carefully scanning a patient's hand for a vein.
Let's see. Do a tourniquet, all right? It's going to be tight.
Puebla is with Circle the City, a nonprofit that provides mobile health care to the city's homeless population.
All right, it's tight, all right? Let me clean, and then we're going to try this.
The patient is so dehydrated, he's barely able to stay upright. People in this condition can actually become unable to drink water or keep it down. So Pueblo wants to give him fluids intravenously.
You gotta stay awake.
Not awake.
Thank you. There's a poke, okay? Deep breath for me.
IV rehydration is typically done in emergency rooms, but Puebla says unhoused people often don't want to go to the hospital.
Because they don't want to lose their belongings, all their belongings that they have to have with them, which is everything that they own, right? And they don't want to leave their pets behind. They're part of their family. So we encountered a lot of those problems.
So in May, Circle the City started offering IV rehydration right on the streets. Dr. Jim Withers is the founder of the Street Medicine Institute, a nonprofit that trains and equips street medicine teams around the globe. He says Puebla's team is leading the charge.
It very much is in the spirit of street medicine, which is to adapt to the people and the circumstances that they're living in, rather than expecting them to come to the system.
It's also something those who work in the system, traditional brick-and-mortar emergency rooms, generally support, including Dr. Asia Terry, an associate professor of emergency medicine and health policy at George Washington University and the president of the American College of Emergency Physicians in Washington, D.C.
We like to, in many instances, think of ourselves as MacGyvers, in fact, to figure out how to make it work, regardless of resources or it being ideal.
Which means meeting the patient wherever they are. But there are instances where IV rehydration could cause more harm, she says, and that's where the resources of an ER, like access to a lab and higher levels of care, could potentially be life-saving. At the same time, Terry echoes what Perla Puebla said earlier. This is a population that is often reluctant to go to the ER, even if it means possibly dying on the streets. Back at the soup kitchen, Puebla is having trouble establishing the IV in her patient's vein. He tells her that he's been using IV drugs for 30 years.
It's not threading in. Have you used this one a lot? Yeah, okay. No go.
It just won't work. Puebla tells the man to go to the emergency room and offers to call Uber Health, a non-emergency medical transport. He says he'll go, but wants to eat first. His friend, Victor Flores, who was also seen by the team, is worried.
Last night he didn't look good. Like, we got scared.
Flores says he and the man have a place to live, but don't have air conditioning. And this summer is shaping up to be worse than last year, which was the hottest on record.
Increíblemente mortal. It's bad. It's really, really bad.
Flores and his friend head to the soup kitchen.
It is discouraging. I don't like to miss IV, especially because we could have really helped them feel better. But I understood going in with the history of drug use like that was going to be a very difficult stick.
Puebla takes the unused 1-liter saline bag and tosses it in the garbage, then prepares to see her next patient. Her team will wrap up around noon and be back out early the next day, driving around the parks or near the city's lengthy canals, looking for patients who are trying to survive another day of triple-digit heat. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. You can test your state smarts with our new A to Z quiz. There are two quizzes each week starting on Tuesdays and Fridays. And bonus, you can grab the new KJZZ Play sticker at play.kjzz.org. In education news, Arizona requires teachers to tell law enforcement if they think a child is being abused. It's called mandatory reporting, and a group of Southeast Valley parents has been calling attention to it at state school board meetings in recent months. As a new academic year starts, some are urging Chandler Unified Schools to hire student advocates to work with administrators and campus-based police officers. Matthew Casey reports.
Reagan Hookham is a high school junior. She lives in Gilbert and has classes this year on two campuses, about a 30-minute drive apart. Hookham sits at the dining room table talking logistics with her mom, Karen.
And what time do you get done with classes at Perry?
11.
Okay. And then you have to report right to EBIT?
Yeah, but I don't start EBIT until the 24th.
Right.
The East Valley Institute of Technology in Mesa offers Hookham a head start on becoming a physical therapist. Her own recovery from major shoulder surgery made her want to help kids going through similar struggles. She has not chosen a university.
I don't know yet. Hopefully either Florida or Michigan, because those are the top two PT schools.
Perry High is part of Chandler Unified, and it's where Hookham will spend school day mornings. Last year, she made friends there who are now seniors. A new school year means a chance to meet people in her own class.
I don't know. I just hope that they, like, want to know about me and not, like, the rumors and stuff that went around.
The whispers started back in seventh grade after Hookham and other girls at Castile High School reported sexual misconduct allegations against their drama teacher. A years-long fight with Chandler schools ensued. Then in March, Hookham and her parents sued the district, alleging that employees conspired to not tell police what happened.
Under Arizona law, school personnel must report to law enforcement immediately, either electronically or by telephone, if they believe that a minor is the victim of abuse.
Attorney Larry Wolken does not represent the Hookham family. Wolken does have experience with cases involving mandatory reporting. He says a failure to meet the requirement can draw a criminal charge that can be a high misdemeanor or low felony.
I'm unfamiliar with any prosecutions that have been made as a result of a teacher failing to report.
Chandler Schools declined an interview request. The district also did not comment on the Hookham lawsuit. A spokesperson says all staff do yearly training that exceeds legal requirements for mandatory reporting. At a school board meeting weeks after the Hookham case was filed, Chandler Unified School Board member Kurt Roars said some parents had been complaining about principals and staff deciding which incidents to tell police about.
What I'm getting to is there is no policy that I can find that says this is the priority. If there's a suspected crime, you talk to law enforcement first before starting your investigation. And then they decide if they want to continue or not and turn it back to you.
Roars made the comments during a review of district policy on retaliation, bullying, and social media.
You know, just as an aside, in this district, we've gotten some very serious trouble where we've tried to handle an incident on campus that turned out to be a serious crime, and then law enforcement stepped in.
About 7 years ago, three leaders at Hamilton High School were criminally investigated in a so-called hazing scandal. Chandler police recommended they be prosecuted for failing to report sexual assault allegations involving football players. At a news conference months later, then-County Attorney Bill Montgomery said there would be no further charges than the ones brought against three players.
Due to the lack of cooperation from players with firsthand information needed to corroborate allegations detailed through the Chandler Police Department investigation, we are unable to file charges beyond the three cases that we have prosecuted so far.
Two of the Hamilton High staff members who were criminally investigated were reassigned and now work at district headquarters. Reagan Hookham's parents say they wanted law enforcement involved from the start. Father Darren recently told the state school board about what happened after his daughter and other girls reported their drama teacher to an assistant principal.
The school then documented the sexual exploitation of multiple minors occurring over a period of months, and they did not report.
Darren Hookham is one of the parents who's been calling attention to mandatory reporting. He says schools should create a position to advocate for students believed to be abused.
But because we are not the first victims of their egregious activity or even an isolated incident, we ask that you work with community leaders to create a parental bill of rights.
Chandler schools have detailed policy requiring employees to immediately report child abuse. The district spokesperson says a teen violence advisory committee has met twice and mandatory reporting has been a discussion topic. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In arts news, more than 1,000 young dancers from all around the West descended on Phoenix last week for their chance at thousands of dollars in college scholarships. As Phil Latzman tells us, a New York City organization is scouting for talent and helping them level the dance floor for future careers.
We're inside the MacArthur Ballroom at Phoenix's famous Biltmore Hotel, where ballet dancers are plieing, pointing, and pirouetting in front panel that includes college recruiters and instructors from the New York City Dance Alliance. Why are they here in Arizona in the middle of the summer?
Absolutely a wealth of talent here.
That's Sasha Radetzky, a former soloist with American Ballet Theater and a principal with the Dutch National Ballet. He now teaches his craft at the Alliance.
You know, coming from New York, and you know, we're always a little cynical, maybe, but they dance with full hearts, and they're just so eager to learn, and the way they support one another and cheer one another on, their laser focus. I mean, there are hundreds of kids in a room, but you can hear a pin drop.
That's because there is a lot on the line. Specifically up to $100,000 in scholarship money.
We seek to kind of democratize the art form and provide opportunities, just like New York City Dance Alliance is, to those who maybe otherwise wouldn't have those chances.
The man in charge of the event is Joe Lantieri, who founded the NYCDA 3 decades ago to help even the bar for future professional dancers.
Dancers have big dreams. They just need access, and in this case, they're perhaps looking for some financial support so that they can pursue both their education and their training.
Among those who've come through the Alliance are Oscar winner Ariana DuBose and Dancing with the Stars judge Derek Hoff. As rows and rows of dancers perform, Lantieri and his judges watch closely and take notes.
Dance, like any art, is subjective, and I think it is person by person. So sometimes someone strikes you because of their technical proficiency. Sometimes it is something you can feel their spirit come. There's a light that's on. You know, sometimes it is that raw potential that you go, wow, with a little more training, this is going to be a superstar.
The Alliance scouts dancers as young as 7 or 8, but Lantieri believes many of them don't come into their own until high school, time when many teens fret over body image.
You're allowed to come in all shapes and sizes because you do bring your own unique self to it. And when that uniqueness is what is actually celebrated, then there really are no limits.
Also at the judges' table are representatives from more than a dozen college dance programs, including from the University of Arizona. Elizabeth George is an associate professor at the U of A's School of Dance.
Is there one skill you're looking for more than another when you're recruiting these kids?
I really feel like we're looking for just an openness in general to movement and to constructive critique. And in our school, we really look for strength in all genres.
And while ballet is on display in this particular audition, jazz and contemporary dancers are also being reviewed. George says Arizona's dance scene is vibrant.
There is a really strong community between the universities, all of the small studios in Phoenix and Tucson. We have students who come from all over the state, and then we also have alumni who've graduated from our program who are also teaching and dancing all over the state.
Goodyear's Madison Green will soon be one of her pupils. She's headed for Tucson after graduating from Millennium High School.
Last year, I participated in the college scholarship audition and auditioned in front of 12 to 15 different college programs, and I received 3 offers from different colleges. And this year I'm back again to audition for foundation money because there's no place that provides what Joe does with NYCDA.
Lantieri says while success is not guaranteed, many have the potential to live their dreams and dance for a living.
Do I think all of these dancers will end up in a Broadway show or touring with a major company of some sort? No, but do I think all of them could find a home where they feel fulfilled because they're on stage using the talent that they've been given? Yeah, I think if they go find their stage, most of these dancers could go have a career.
Over the years, the Alliance has awarded about $5 million in scholarships to over 500 dancers, helping facilitate their education, both on the dance floor and in the classroom. This year, many of them could come from right here in Arizona. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You can see pictures and video of the big dance at kjzz.org. And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In Fronteras News, the city of Sedona has fired its housing manager just before an important election to determine the city's future housing plan. From the Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Michelle Morisco reports.
Shannon Boone was hired in late September 2021 as Sedona's housing manager and was contracted out to nearby Cottonwood. Sedona says she's now been fired because she didn't meet the professional standards laid out in Sedona's employee manual. Specifically, she was quoted by the local Red Rock News in an email to the city's housing advisory group calling opponents of a plan, quote, short-sighted, selfish bullies. Under Boone's tenure, the city embarked on a so-called Safe Place to Park program that is intended to help locally employed workers to live in their cars at a city-owned park. Opponents deem it a homeless camp. They completed a referendum that puts the future of the proposed camp in the hands of voters in November. Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
And finally, in original productions. It's been 10 years since the wait time scandal at the Phoenix VA. Let's get some analysis about how they've done. The show's co-host Mark Brody has the story.
This spring marked the 10-year anniversary of whistleblowers shining light on long waits for veterans to get care at the Phoenix VA, as well as the existence of secret waiting lists aimed at hiding that information. Investigations revealed several veterans died as a result of this delayed care. The scandal extended to other VA facilities beyond Phoenix as well and led to more oversight of the system, as well as a plan to allow veterans to see medical providers outside of the VA if it'd take too long to see their VA doctor. There are differing opinions as to whether or not things have improved in the system over the last decade, and today we'll hear two perspectives on that. We start with Darren Selnick, a retired Air Force officer and former VA employee, including a senior advisor to the VA secretary during the Trump administration. He's also senior advisor to the group Concerned Veterans for America. And when I spoke with him earlier, I asked where he thinks the VA is now relative to where it was a decade ago and where it's been over the last 10 years.
Well, it's sad to see, but it's like deja vu back in 2014 all over again. I was part of, as being senior advisor to the secretary, I was part of making up the Mission Act and implementing the Mission Act and making sure that through access standards, which were similar to DOD's, that no veteran would have to wait too long or drive too far to get care. And unfortunately, what I've been seeing is someone who wrote this stuff up is we're seeing in Phoenix and in other parts of the country where they don't actually follow the access standards. Veterans are getting delayed care, denied care.
Are you still finding that there are, for example, secret wait lists and things like that? Or is it, and I don't mean to minimize it by saying just, but is the problem mostly now that it's just taking too long for veterans to see a provider?
Yes, it is taking too long. And The problem is veterans are not being told that they are eligible, or they're trying to meet the access standards by giving veterans an appointment before the access standard and then canceling them, or never telling them that they're eligible for community care. So it goes on and on. They wait times that they post on the website are incorrect wait times because by regulation, you're supposed to calculate wait times by date of request. It makes sense. I call up. I ask for an appointment, that's when the clock starts. But they're still using the 2014 way of doing business, which is a patient indicated date or a clinic date where they say, hey, you know, you don't need to be seen for a certain amount of time, so we're not going to start calculating it. And it's the delays that kill veterans for cancer and other things.
For veterans who are trying to get care through the VA, is it kind of like what we see in many cases, especially here in Phoenix and elsewhere also, in healthcare, there just aren't enough providers for the number of patients who need to see them?
No, that's not really the problem. The problem with the VA is that they're so inefficient in seeing people. So if to do a direct comparison, I use Camp Pendleton Hospital, military hospital. And on average, in the military, they see 19 patients a day. Staff is telling me that they're down to as low as sometimes 3 to 5 patients or 6 patients a day. So, you know, if you have the staff, but you are inept in your operation, that's the problem. But even if the VA didn't have enough staff, which they do, they have like twice the ratio of staff that like a Kaiser does, then that's why you have community care. So if there is a long wait time, the whole point of the access standards is that if you have mental health or primary care and there's a wait of more than 20 days, they're supposed to offer you community care. If you have more than a 28-day wait for specialty care, they're supposed to offer you community care. Now, you don't have to take community care if you like that doctor and you want to wait longer. But the point is you should not have 3, 4, 5, 6 months. And a lot of doctors are getting in trouble because they are putting veterans in community care and then getting in trouble for it. And they're doing it because they have waits of 3, 4, 5 months.
When you talk about community care, or, you know, getting, you know, seeing a physician in private practice, I mean, anybody who's called to try to make an appointment will tell you they, you know, any random person would tell you that it can still sometimes take 2, 3, 4 months to see a provider, depending on the specialty. So I wonder, like, yes, you know, the VA should be, according to the law and the standards, referring veterans to community care if the wait is too long at the VA. But does just referring them to community care guarantee they're going to get in any sooner?
Well, you're right. In healthcare, there's no guarantees. But what's the difference between, because I get asked this question all the time, what's the difference between VA and the private sector, good and bad from both sides? Absolutely. The difference is choice. So if I have a long wait time at the VA and therefore it's a 40-day wait and I go to the community and the best I can find is 50 days, I don't have to use the community. I can use the VA. So I have the choice of best of both worlds if I do. That's the whole point of choice. The difference, though, is if the VA provider is 60 days out, there is no other choice in that VA to find a better choice. But in the community, you can shop around. You can have shop around any provider that provides that in the network, and you can shop around and you can say, hey, I need to get this treatment. My experience in the private sector is if a particular provider has a long wait time, normally practices will offer you another provider with a much shorter wait time, especially if you tell them, hey, I need to be seen, because all doctor practices have holes in their schedule. So you can literally shop around, and I've done that myself, to go ahead and get the appointment that I want.
So given the problems that you're describing that are still within the VA, you know, a decade after this initial scandal broke, do you think that there is still a place for the VA, or do you think this country needs to sort of blow up the system of healthcare for military veterans and maybe start over?
Well, I think there's definitely a place for the VA. It just needs to be modernized. The VA is running like a 1990s healthcare system. And so who did modernize? DOD did. And so DOD has about 2/3 of its care in the community because there's just not enough, you know, retired veterans and stuff like that who use the DOD that are close enough to the facilities. And the same thing happens to the VA. The VA's mission is service-connected. It needs to focus on that and not try to do everything for everybody. When you try to do that, you don't do anything well for anybody if you try to do everything for anybody. So it needs to modernize. Bad employees need to be held accountable. And it needs the competition. It needs to know that if veterans don't like it, they can go somewhere else, and that's how they're going to improve their customers. So it's definitely a role. But veterans are not going to want to use the VA if the VA provides bad customer service and bad access, no matter how good the quality is. If you can't get it, it doesn't matter. I'm not someone who advertises to get rid of the VA. What I support, what Concerned Veterans for America support, is the Veterans Healthcare Freedom Act, which was a Commission on Care recommendation that I was on, that says veterans at all times should have the ability to pick between the VA facilities and the community care and be able to make the decision based on what's best for them.
Darren Selnick was senior advisor to the VA secretary during the Trump administration and is currently senior advisor to the group Concerned Veterans for America. Not everyone, though, shares his opinions. David Lucier, for one, has a much better view of the VA 10 years since the scandal. Lucier served in the U.S. Army Special Forces and is a member of the Arizona Veterans Hall of Fame. He's also active in a number of veterans groups and established a nonprofit called the Arizona Veterans and Military Leadership Alliance. When I spoke with him earlier, I asked the same question. Where does he think the VA is now relative to where it's been over the last decade?
We are much, much better off. The VA today is operationally much, much better than it was, say, 10, 12 years ago.
What's changed?
Well, for one, leadership. The other thing is that all the stakeholders, many of the stakeholders are involved. We got the veterans community involved. We got our elected leaders involved. We got administrators at the our local VA, and we also went to Washington and talked to the Secretary of the VA about the condition and operation of our Phoenix VA.
Would you say that that scandal sort of was the impetus for these changes? Like, did that happening lead to these changes specifically, do you think?
Absolutely. They absolutely did. No doubt about it. We got to a low point. You know, it's just like, you know, when you need treatment for, you know, drug addiction or alcohol, you got to hit a, you know, rock bottom. And I think that's kind of where we were. There was a lot of problems there. And so, again, stakeholders got together, hammered out what was wrong, identified those problems, and then came up with solutions to fix them. And, of course, that was mostly on the VA. It wasn't an easy journey. But it was certainly a successful one.
I'm curious a little bit about that journey. I mean, was it a straight line? It sounds like it wasn't, from rock bottom to the improvement that you're citing now. I mean, was it kind of a zigzag and a lot of maybe not consensus about what the right solutions would be, that kind of thing?
Projects and initiatives and programs, they're like cash flows. They're uneven. They always are. But I think that we kept our eye on the ball and we kept our eyes on the mission and the objective. And the objective was to bring our VA up to a standard that we could all be proud of. And I think that we've reached that and we've been able to maintain it for several years.
So what is your experience now? You're a military veteran. When you call the VA to get an appointment or to see a provider, what is your experience typically like?
Well, typically, you'll tell the appointment person or your medical team. I generally go online and I say, you know, I'd like an appointment for, you know, this, that, or the other. Then I get a phone call back. We understand you want an appointment. They confirm I want an appointment for XYZ. And then they say, well, listen, we can get you in on 20 days hence. Okay, so you go for it. But the rule is that if there's a time and distance rule. So if you're far enough away or the appointment that you're being scheduled for is more than, I believe, 28 or 30 days out, then you have the option to go into the community for that care.
To see it like a private practice doctor.
See a private practice doctor. And so and that is just the standard. I'll call it a script because they're very strict about that these days. And so they will say, hey, I can fit you in 45 days at the VA, or we can put you out in the community. And it's your option.
Well, it's interesting that you refer to it as sort of the script and that they're strict about mentioning that under certain conditions, you are free to go and see a community provider, because there have been concerns and people have expressed them that the VA is not doing a good enough job of telling veterans that if they have to wait X number of days to see a provider at the VA, that they do have the option of seeing a community provider. It sounds like that has not been the case for you.
No, my experience and folks that I, you know, engage with during the normal course of my business basically have said the same thing. Now, I'm sure that it's not 100%. No system is perfect. And trying to reach perfection in this life is a bit of a folly. So, but if we do come across those are the kind of things that, you know, everybody wants to know about because they want to fix it.
When you see a VA provider, you're offered an appointment, does it tend to be within a reasonable amount of time? Because that was one of the big problems, again, a decade ago, that the wait times were months and months. It was really, really a long time. Have those wait times come down to see particular providers?
My experience is that the not only has the wait times in the VA been reduced, and I'll tell you about some limitations on that, but generally that's true. And you know, the private sector medical non-VA involvement. I mean, I'm the second of 11 siblings, and so I got a lot of siblings that are, you know, that do use those services. And in between just getting an appointment And then the billing is just, I mean, I have, you know, sisters who spend a lot of time tracking down, you know, billing and correct billing and getting appointments out in the community is not an easy thing to do. But I think that across the board, the VA's done better at getting their appointments filled. But again, we've got a system, a backup system, where if that's not, you know, if that's not available, then immediately go to the community.
So you are active in a number of veterans groups. I'm curious what you hear from, you know, other military veterans about their experiences with the VA, both positive and negative. Like, sure. What are people saying right now?
I think across the board, people are very positive about it. Folks like myself, now I've been there for several years. In fact, I was there when things weren't so good. And so I've seen remarkable improvements. But, you know, veterans, especially when you get them in a group, can be pretty vocal. And they can be sarcastic, but they're about, you know, hitting that nail on the head. And so if they have a bad experience, they'll say so. And I just don't hear very many bad experiences. You know, it doesn't appear to be anything right now systemic. I think, you know, we've addressed those problems pretty well. Again, it's not perfect. I get that. But it is way better than what we've experienced a decade ago.
David Lucier is a member of the Arizona Veterans Hall of Fame and head of the nonprofit Arizona Veterans and Military Leadership Alliance.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.